ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, Jules and Jez here. Join us as we unpack the news of the week on Not Stupid.
Greenland is depicted the same size as Africa, but Africa is 14 times the size.
A lot bigger than the Mercator map shows.
And I wonder if Donald Trump knows that Greenland is not that big.
You can find Not Stupid on the ABC Listen app. Politics often doesn't stop for public holidays, and it appears the Liberal leadership tensions continue to grow. And while Liberals still see Susan Lee's leadership as untenable, there's a desire for Conservatives Andrew Hastie and Angus Taylor to sort out which of them will run before triggering a spill for a deal in the right side of politics. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister has announced Defence Department boss Greg Moriarty as the new US ambassador after Kevin Rudd announced his early departure from the role. It comes as Anthony Albanese labels US President Donald Trump's comments about Allied troops staying a little off the front lines in Afghanistan as not acceptable. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm Jacob Greber. You look like you've had a really sleepy few days. You've just been in the hammock, the political observer's hammock of
leisure. Do I look relaxed,
last week.
Do I look relaxed and comfortable?
You do.
Like John Howard's 1996 Australia? Is that how I'm looking to you?
Yeah. You know, events where politically not much happens.
Nah, nothing.
Weeks, you know, nah. Go by. It seems to suit you.
Yeah.
More seriously, what a week to have missed.
You missed it, but you were clearly not missing it. I did not miss it. I was like swimming in it, Jacob. I was swimming in the Liberal national brouhaha fight. Where is it now? Where are we? It's had a huge impact, though, and it will continue to. So after the coalition imploded last week, Susan Lee's leadership was immediately on shaky ground. Fran and I actually spoke about this, Jacob, in the party room about who's in line for the role. And ever since, over the weekend, I can report to you that this continues. Andrew Hastie and a story in The Australian, for instance, that his family has given him their blessing. Now he has three young kids. A wife, they're in WA. Why does that matter? Well, that's seriously very hard for any politician who's in the West to maintain a national role like that. So, you know, the blessing, I suppose, does matter because you pretty much don't see your family if you are a West Australian politician and become a leader. So that there's that story interestingly placed. Then there is a story over the weekend, different people reporting different things that Angus Taylor called Andrew Hastie and said, hey, you be my deputy, which, by the way, that's another chapter. How do you do that? So what, the two right-wing conservatives kind of stitch up the whole leadership, like, how do the moderates feel about that? But anyway, you be my deputy and, you know, eventually you'll become the leader. And Hastie's like, nah, mate, like, this is me paraphrasing, okay? I'll be running my own race. And so, yeah, it's been
there's a lot to unpack, isn't there? There's a lot to unpack here, and there's a lot still happening. But I just want to make an observation as someone who watched this all from afar last week, between, you know, the good things you do when you get some time off. It was really striking to me watching, I guess, Australia on holiday, where the focus is, you know, making sure that you've got enough steaks for the barbie that night. The caravan's all fueled up and everyone's driving very, very big cars. God, everyone's driving such big cars these days, PK. I don't know what's happened out there. It is wild.
I have a really small car, but yeah, okay, I understand others.
They're
like
huge.
A big car.
So I look at every morning I'd walk the dog along the beach and then have a cup of coffee. And it was opposite this caravan park. And I kept looking at those folks thinking, what on earth is the Liberal Party doing for these folks? How are they talking to those people? And my answer was, they're not. They're talking to themselves about themselves. And so they've disconnected. They've disconnected from Australia. And I think that is a big part of why they're in so much strife. And you saw it all live. You had that that dramatic poll that came out that had One Nation on par, you know, ahead of the coalition.
Ahead, but, you know, just.
And then all hell breaks loose. They walked straight into the Prime Minister's trap, the wedges that he had lined up for them. Oh, you want me to come back early? Okay, I'll come back early. Here's a bill. And they completely fell apart on it. So you sit there and go, how does that connect with the average Australian going about their business in the summer? And I just thought, you couldn't have it worse. Like, it's so bad for the brand. It's so bad for what they purport to sort of be about when they tell us all in these sort of morning radio interviews that they're focused on the Australian people. No, they're not.
Well, they're not acting like they are. So it doesn't really matter what they say publicly, because Australians will judge people by impressions and just moments. That's how we know people consume politics, Jacob. And the impressions and the optics here are pretty clear. They keep talking about themselves. They talk a big game. For instance, they talked a big game about anti-Semitism, and then on the most important day, commemorating the death of 15 lives on the back of what was anti-Semitic, right? We know that. There was a focus, because of the Nationals, to put the sort of blame where it deserves to be here, on them. I mean, there is, with the fullness of time, I think there'll be a lot of red faces there realising just how bad that looked. It was quite odd that they didn't realise at the time, but let's just leave that there.
Yeah. I just think from the point of view of the coalition, it's been a long-standing trend, this problem that they've had. And the election certainly blew that all out into the open. How do they reconnect with those voters? And some of those voters will have clearly gone to One Nation, and others feel, you know what, the Labor Party just offers a better deal. I don't follow the ins and outs of politics, they might say to themselves, but the Labor Party is a more stable outfit. It is providing relief where they need it and when they need it. It's pretty simple. What is the Liberal Party doing to reconnect with those voters?
Well, it's very simple. And, you know, I reported about the delay in the election review, which gives some sort of steer about the way that they run campaigns.
And that was a staggering, that to me is staggering, you know, and that just again points to the, and it was a really good story, but like you, gobsmacking that they would now be seeking to somehow not front up to the causes that led them to this defeat and has them now where they are.
Mm.
And by which I mean, you know, the as you reported, this talk of now it being too libelous to go down and look at this document, essentially. So I think to get back to the here and now of this week, obviously this week there is maybe a little bit of a hiatus because of it's Australia Day. There's also a funeral coming up. And also, here's the real reason people might think some of the heat's come out of this in the last day or so. They're not all in the same room. Next week, they're all back in the same room. So who do you think has both the argument for why they should tear down Susan Lee and has the support to do it?
Great question. Here's my answer. Who has the support? I've made a lot of calls on this, and the absolute problem as we, you know, record this on a Monday morning, I call it problem because it's a bit of a wicked problem for the conservative side, is that it's kind of evenly split. And I've had that from different sources, and so I believe it. It's, you know, between the Angus Taylor sort of approach and then the Andrew Hastie approach. And their approaches, they might both be capital C conservatives, because they are, but they are very different kind of campaigners. Ideologically, I think they, of course, they share some common visions, but they have very different, and we focus a lot on the cultural, Jacob, but I think we're not focusing enough on the economic. I really don't. I don't think we're telling that story enough. And some of the differences I'm seeing between them as candidates are very much on those issues. You know, I think actually on the conservative kind of culture war, if you want to call them that, there'd probably be some similarities actually between them, maybe on emphasis or how they pitch it. That might be different. But on the economics, I think we've got some very different visions. I think Andrew Hastie is very much in the populist school now of economics, right? He's really kind of studied this, believes in this third way. I'm calling it a third way, you know what I mean? Like a different approach to right-wing politics, trying to read what he thinks is a change and anti-establishment mood. So he's trying to do something quite fascinating in many ways, which is to use the conservative architecture but change it from within to depict it to a kind of growing cohort of Gen X men and others as who are kind of looking for change, as able to deal with their economic woes and their grievances differently, not sort of a traditional liberal establishment, Collins Street vision of the Liberal Party. Angus Taylor, however, is still a small government guy, you know, a sort of big end of town type of dude. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, he probably wouldn't love that description, but I'm trying to sort of find a form of language for the sort of liberal he is. And so right now they're evenly split. That's a problem, of course, because they're both on the same sort of side of the faction, if you like. So they have to sort it out, the right. And then there's the moderates, and that's the key thing. Where do they swing? Some of them, I interviewed Julian Lisa the other day, for instance. He's a very senior moderate. I mean, he is like wedded to Susan Lee because he believes that she took a very strong stand on anti-Semitism and the hate laws at the end, and actually should be supported for and not be knocked off by, you know, the Nationals having a tantrum or a right-wing push against her, and that she stood her ground on a very, very important issue. So I'm making a big call here, but I do think there will be a spill. I think there is a momentum for one now. I know the right doesn't want both Andrew Hastie and Angus Taylor to stand. They want a deal, but they don't have one yet as we record on a Monday. So it's anyone's guess if someone withdraws. I don't know if we're going to see a withdrawal. I haven't seen any evidence for a withdrawal. And at the end of the day, Susan Lee, she's digging her heels in. What do you think?
Look, I think she will sort of dig in for now. The question is, as you laid out, what the right decides. And they do have to, within that cohort of about, what is it, 20 to 25 people in the party room, roughly. There's the people in the middle, the moderates, and then the cons. The right has to decide whether they're going to put Hastie forward or Angus Taylor forward. And there's a couple of people, there's a couple of really key people who you're going to have to watch very closely to see which way they break on this question. James Patterson's an obvious one, very important player on the right. The way he goes will probably determine which of those two get up. There are others like John O'Dunham. Jane Hume is an important player, even though she's from actually the moderate wing. She worked very closely with Angus Taylor.
She is so in the Angus camp.
She will matter.
Put her in the Angus camp.
And then, actually, weirdly enough, there are also the sort of personalities, and this is normal for the Liberal Party, by the way. Mm. They don't have factions like Labor does, which tend to have a little more of an ideological underpinning. These factions are often congeal around personalities. There will be people on the moderate side who cannot stomach either of those two. And so the right will have to make that calculation. Who among the moderates do they draw to their side, depending on which man they pick, Taylor or Hastie? Or maybe they pick someone else. Maybe they pick someone else altogether. You know, I don't think it's necessarily just to those two versus Lee.
So well said. Now, I still think it's mainly them. I will say that.
Yes.
Right?
No, it is. They're the ones. They're the ones that everyone's talking about.
They are. But, and they're the ones that have sort of got the hunger for it, and they're campaigning right for it. And as a result, you'd have to put them on the sort of as front runners. However, you are right. And let me give you a historical example, my friends. Scott Morrison coming through the middle. Do we recall that moment? I do. That's how he became Prime Minister. So sometimes that happens. Now, that's where you look at someone like Ted O'Brien, or, you know, being sort of a bit, you know, Dantean, like these guys kind of being a bit mischievous. Melissa McIntosh, of course, has been actually throwing a hat in the ring, kind of going, why don't you look at women? What's your fear, guys? Like, she's won this seat over and over that, you know, was very difficult, the outer west, you know, so she's kind of like, come on, I'm the heartland, the new heartland, as she likes to describe it. So there are other players for sure, and sometimes you got to look left field. But I suppose even the fact that we're having at length this conversation proves the very central point, which is Susan Lee's leadership is toast. Like, she can survive two more weeks, but who cares?
But why is her leadership toast?
Because her party has destroyed it. They don't believe in it. How can it continue?
Yeah.
That's why.
From the get-go, she's had very few natural allies in that role. One of my first pieces that I produced or wrote for 7:30 last year was to mark the fact that she was the first woman to stand at that opposition leader's dispatch box as a Liberal since the party that was created by Robert Menzies 80 years ago had come together. The first woman in history. You would think that is a big moment for the Liberal Party to celebrate, to actually be willing to put up in lights. I can tell you it took a lot of cajoling. It took 24 phone calls, all of whom were either not available or just wouldn't speak, to stand up in front of a camera and mark that moment. And I'm talking here about, actually, these were mostly women in the Liberal Party I was chasing, former and existing, to mark that moment, to talk about its significance, to recognize it. And I thought at that point, wow, this woman has almost no natural allies. So she's had it stacked against her from the word go. She's also got a National Party former coalition partner that is not acting in a way that would help her. They've twice now broken apart. They've twice now threatened all sorts of things. They're going to go at themselves, to hell with the Liberals. So yeah, she's had it stacked against her. But is there something about her in particular, do you think, that means she's terminal?
So she's had it stacked against her. I would put most of it in column A, which is that one. But there is a column B. And, you know, you have to hold people to account for some of their own doing. I think one of the biggest criticisms of Susan Lee is that she hasn't led, that she has been a leader by committee, if you like, right? Now, I understand why she's done that. She has tried to be the anti-Peter Dutton, I've described it as before, right? Like, I'm not going to do captain's calls. I'm going to listen to my party. I'm going to go through processes. She's trying to make it a virtue. But in that process, she's lost some authority because it looks like she doesn't think anything. She doesn't believe anything. And in fact, I think it is interesting that the first time she sort of stood up on something was the anti-Semitism. Now, some people would say she went too far after Bondi, got too political, and I can see that critique. But she did stand on something, and then she did stand on saying we must do a deal on hate laws at the end after saying the first bill version was unsalvageable. Then she found a salvageable second version, right? I think that was the time where she did stand up. Ironically, it's when things fell apart for her, because they like it when she doesn't stand up, don't they?
Yes, but I think and I think there's a frustration tactically with her tactical nous as well, or her team's tactical nous, to have demanded Parliament come back ad nauseam in the wake of Bondi was one thing, but then that eventually leads it back to the Prime Minister, who has all sorts of levers, all sorts of ways to influence events. When you force him to bring Parliament back early, he then can do things that hurt you. And he did it by combining those two elements of the bill, the hate vilification element and the gun element, into one bill that caused mayhem for the coalition. And there was a question people had tactically about the wisdom of having kind of beat the table, actually almost literally, to make Parliament come back. Look, is she toast? It has that feel about it, PK, but I think the Liberal Party still has to explain to Australians why they think she's toast and why they move on her if and when they eventually do.
Yeah, oh, I think that's all correct. But the reason she's toast is because even the most... I just can't find someone other than the public statements. It's different, but I mean, when I speak to them privately who are saying, oh, this is fine, no one. Have you found someone who says, oh, yeah, she'll be the leader at the next election and means it?
No.
No, right? We have to be honest with our listeners. No one. Have you found a moderate who says she'll be a leader at the next election?
I've found moderates who are frustrated that they would roll her now.
Yes, me too.
Because it would
reward the Nats.
Reward the National Party and the National Party's tantrum over how this has all unfolded. It would reward people like Canavan, who've been able to play a blinder on this by hammering into the internal weakness on the National Party by putting out very strident positions about hate speech and gun laws well before they got to Parliament. That always immediately put pressure on the leadership. The leadership then buckled in the last week, and then you had what we all saw last week. So yeah, where are we going with all of this? You know, how does it land? We'll see in a week or two, but I think there were moderates, to answer your question, PK, who feel that she should still be given a lot more time than this.
Yeah, I think that's true. But even those moderates can see that it's unlikely she'll make it all the way to the next election. Mm. All right, let's radically pivot to a little thing called, are you ready, guys? The government, the actual people in charge.
How quaint. How quaint of you.
Oh. I know.
The government.
So there are these people, they've got 94 seats in the lower house of Australia, in the House of Representatives, and they've got actual power. One of these key figures, I'm talking like David Attenborough, is a man called Anthony Albanese, who did an interview with a man called David Spears on Insiders. And I'm saying a man a lot, doesn't that say a lot? The PM announced on Insiders that the Defence Department boss, Greg Moriarty, oh my God, another man, will be Kevin Rudd's replacement as US ambassador. Oh my God, another man. Sorry, I'm having a moment after
you've picked up a theme here.
Mate, come on. So we've got a new US ambassador that's been announced, just sort of thrown into that interview with David Spears, who's a little nugget. What do you think of this choice?
Look, I think it's – so the first thought I had was – Washington is Canberra on steroids. It is Canberra times 1,000, by which I mean it is the most fast-moving, ruthless, politically transactional place you could ever go to. To the point where you'll meet a random person who'll find out within seconds who you are, what you are, and whether you can be of any assistance to their progression in life. It's so staggering when you get there, the speed with which people work you out and decide whether you're going to get 3 seconds or 3 weeks of their attention. So that's my preamble to say you want an ambassador to Washington who can play that game. And one of the ways that you go up the list of people that people in Congress, people in Senate, people in the White House will spend time with you is if they're convinced that as an ambassador, you have the ear of the Prime Minister back home. Otherwise, if you're just a bureaucrat, if you're just a technocrat, they're not going to waste much of their time with you. They're going to pick up the phone and try and talk to that Prime Minister directly. Now, I'm not saying Greg Moriarty is just a bureaucrat, just a technocrat. He's much, much more than that. He's one of our most experienced defense officials. He's been in the world of diplomacy. He's been in politics, deeply entrenched. He was a key figure in the AUKUS deal. So he's not a nobody. But titles do kind of matter in that town. If you're a former deputy leader, or we've had a former prime minister, we've had a former treasurer hold those jobs. We've had a former Labor leader hold that job of ambassador. That's generally the sort of thing that the Washington mind kind of gloms onto and says, yes, this is a player. So Greg Moriarty's going to have to overcome that. I'm sure he will. I actually think he's got all of those chops. He did work for Malcolm Turnbull as his chief of staff. So there's a bit of a political sort of cross the aisle element there. Let's wait and see. He's also not the first bureaucrat to get that job. There have been many, and there have been many effective ones. But if you've got a bureaucrat running the embassy in Washington, you then also need very, very good political connections between our leaders and our ministers and their equivalents in the US, because you can't rely on the ambassador in the same way that you might if you have a real political person in that job. There you go.
Yeah, I think that was great summary of all of the elements there. But I also think, you know, let's not forget why this appointment's happened, and that is very clearly this man has no digital kind of footprint of his thoughts of Donald Trump. Like, he's a low-risk candidate as well. Now that Anthony Albanese has established a relationship with Trump, right, it went pretty well. They don't have the need like they did when there was, you know, basically nothing.
I think that's he might changed. Have his mobile phone number.
Yeah, now. Right? Yeah. Don't you think that makes a big difference?
So, yes.
Yeah, the in there makes a really big difference. So I don't know. Everything's kind of shifts as a result.
It will be a really tough job. I mean, there's so much challenging stuff on that relationship to be dealt with. The AUKUS is just the half of it. There's the relationships with the Congress. There's going to be questions about Donald Trump's handling of the economy and where that all leads. And and he's famous, of course, for spraying in all sorts of directions. And so you're always under pressure as ambassador to respond to every little twist and turn.
Mm. Now, the other thing that's happened over the weekend, which I think is really just so troubling, really is very
troubling.
Well,
this is an example of what I'm talking about.
It is. It's right on the theme, is Donald Trump last week suggesting that NATO allied troops, which include, just to be clear, obviously the United States and, of course, Australia in the troops that we're talking about here, stayed a little off the front lines in Afghanistan. Okay? So,
as you know, they were sort of back from where the real fighting was happening.
So he's mocking the contribution of the troops. And also, I mean, he's not thinking about Australia, but that includes us because we were in those campaigns. Everyone would recall that listening. Just to remind you, 47 Australians died in combat and many more were injured. I did what is known in journalism as death knocks. I visited families whose sons had died in Afghanistan. And so I got to say, when I heard the comment before we're about to get to the politics here, I felt sick as well because, you know, there is nothing in journalism, I'm sure you agree, Jacob, like visiting a family that's just found out that their child has died and asking them about that. Like, it's actually very, very, it's just chilling. And
you don't forget those sort of things.
No, you don't. It's like the thing that you do, which is the most difficult, but also the most moving and like reminds you what it is to be human and how important family is. So people have lost their loved ones who were fighting in a war, whatever your view is of that war or that campaign, that is legitimate, but they were fighting for their country. And now we've got lots of political commentary around it. Anthony Albanese was asked by our colleague, David Spears. He said it was not acceptable, but he wasn't exactly, I mean, he did condemn it, to be fair, he did. But really interesting positioning, for instance, from Andrew Hastie, if we can sort of go back to the sort of leadership chat. He's a former SAS soldier. He's been to Afghanistan. I mean, there's nothing more real than that, right?
Mm. Oh, and he called it a massive slur, didn't he? And he had an interesting comment too about leadership. Most important things in building coalitions and alliances is mutual respect, and a really important virtue in a leader is restraint. Maybe part of him is that's him with his little job interview hat on, but I think he's also heartfelt in his anger about that. And it's interesting that he was really the first, I think, in that little short period after those comments were made to come out so strongly among our public figures. And he's, people probably like to say, Andrew Hastie's a very MAGA type character. Well, he's gone after Trump on this. So that'll help his argument that he's not a MAGA type person. He's incensed by these comments and he said it. And I think the Prime Minister's comments compared to those look much more muted, but he is the Prime Minister.
On him is so different, isn't it?
Yeah. He is the Prime Minister. He's got to maintain that relationship. He's clearly said they're not acceptable remarks. He doesn't agree with them. But I guess your contrast is that Keir Starmer went out and said the President had to apologise and talked about what British troops had done, and maybe that was a stronger response.
It was, and he's a prime minister, right? And I think Australia is very important, but we're a middle power. Obviously, the UK on the hierarchy we'd have to accept is, especially just even strategically where it is, Europe at the moment, like is more important.
Yeah, and I was thinking about this because I was watching that speech by the Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney at Davos, where he talked about the fiction that is the rules-based order. Everyone's talked about that speech, but, you've got Carney and the other little bit of news that the Prime Minister revealed on Insiders on Sunday was that Mark Carney is actually coming to Australia in March and will address Parliament. That's one of those sort of honours that governments bestow on foreign leaders quite rarely. That's a pretty unusual. It happens often, but it's a big deal. So you've got Australia standing there with Canada and the UK. It's a really important trio if you go to the Mark Carney speech where he talks about these the middle powers in the world. And Australia, 12th largest economy, member of the G20, is pretty much the definition of a middle power. Mm. It doesn't have any kind of real clout like a US or China does, but it has an incredible amount of convening power and an incredible amount of ability to convince people of different positions and different interests. And I think having those three together, Canada and Australia together, I think that's going to be a really big moment. And the fact that it was announced within hours, really, of that amazing speech by Mark Carney tells you that Albanese's positioning himself to be part of that. You wouldn't call it a resistance to Donald Trump, but it's essentially a bulwark against the sort of global order that Donald Trump wants versus the one that is in Australia's interests.
Yeah, I think Albanese, you're right, is positioning around all of this, but he's also being very, very careful now
very
that he's
careful.
Got the relationship on the rails, personalised it, doesn't want to antagonise. AUKUS is back on track, if you want to call it that. I'm not saying it's entirely on track. I know there's a lot of discussion
the deal is so sweet from America's point of view that, like, why would they renege on it?
Yeah,
whereas Carney's been in an open verbal battle with the president for a year, let's face it, ever since Trump started to talk about taking over Canada. And of course Trump has at various moments slapped Keir Starmer and the UK around. And so it's a much more antagonistic relationship between those two countries and the president, whereas the Australian presidential thing's a bit softer, isn't it? I mean, it hasn't reached that kind of level of aggro, to put it bluntly.
Yeah, I think that's right. Jacob, I love it when you come back to work. I mean, I know you're allowed to have holidays, but come on, don't take weeks like that off. That was hot last week and you missed.
It was okay.
Oh, look, you're back now, and I love your work. Politics Now will be back tomorrow. Tom Crowley will join me for the latest developments. On Thursday, Fran and I will answer all your questions on The Party Room. You can email those questions to theparty@abc.net.au. What can I say? See you, Jacob.
See you, PK.